On the program today, the economic goings-on the past 5 days, oil and gas and Hurricane Harvey, and from a veteran of Afghanistan, how it's going coming home. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 25th day of August. Today, good as always to have you along. Lots to get to on a Friday at the end of August, actually, which used to be back in the day when the news slowed down, if you remember that. Catherine Rampell is at the Washington Post. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. 5 days in this economy, 5 minutes or so. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai. Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you and Fed Chair Janet Yellen. She gave a speech today out of Jackson Hole, Wyoming, at a Fed conference that they have every year out there. She was talking about financial regulation, and she said, in essence, look, we need regulation. Regulation is working. And in what I read as a warning to Republicans and the Trump administration, she said, basically, don't mess with it. What was your take?
That's more or less my takeaway. She basically said that the financial system has gotten substantially safer in the decades since the financial crisis, largely as a result of policy changes, and we shouldn't mess with them too much, although she's open to reviewing some of them, like she mentioned the Volcker Rule. I do think that a lot of the reporting suggesting that she had this like really sharp criticism of the Republican approach is a little bit overstated. I mean, she's made these points before, so it's not like this was out of the blue.
Are people paying attention to her more, Catherine, you think, because of her job conceivably being in peril, which we'll get to in a minute?
I think they're always going to pay attention to Janet Yellen. Oh, yeah. I mean, she has one of the most important jobs in the world. So whether or not her job is on the line, I'm not sure really matters how really affects how influential she actually is at this point. But yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of intrigue about what's going to happen with her.
All right. So, Sudeep, to that point, the guy who is most often mentioned as her potential successor, Gary Cohn, the president, the chairman of the president's National Economic Council, gave an interview to the Financial Times today in which he said a bunch of stuff, tax reform and his reaction to Charlottesville. I want to talk about the tax reform part of this. He says by the end of the year, and he also says that he's willing to give it a try to make it bipartisan. Do you think that will pay off?
Making a try, sure, you can at least make the overtures.
Okay.
Giving it a try actually buys you more time to come up with the details.
That's true.
So they're not really where they expected to be on the details. The Treasury Secretary once said that he expected this to be all wrapped up and finished by August. Others have said October, November. We see the goalposts moving all the time, and they are deliberately trying to buy more time because tax reform and tax policy is the last great hope for salvation for this administration on the policy front. They've been struggling on Obamacare, struggling on so many other things. This is the one thing Republicans feel like they should be able to do, deal with taxation. And they feel like this is their chance to get it right and prove it.
Right. Okay. So politics and legislation aside for a second, Sudeep, talk to me for a minute about these rumors that Gary Cohn is next up at the Fed if he wants the job. Apparently, that's been the reporting. How would the Fed be different? How would monetary policy be different if Gary Cohn's in the job instead of Janet Yellen?
Gary Cohn comes from a very markets-focused perspective, and he's thinking about it from that sense. He also is probably thinking about it more from a business perspective. We've had academics running the Fed for such a long time with a very different framework. Their framework has been deliberately designed around stability. You can debate whether the stability has been too stable, not enough growth, not enough excitement in the economy. But Gary Cohn would be coming in and probably making some big changes from the basic operating framework of the Fed. And we don't know what that means yet, which means some uncertainty.
Catherine, one of the things Gary Cohn was asked about in this FT interview was whether he thinks Congress – basically the question was, what do you think is going to happen with the debt limit? And Gary Cohn said, listen, Congress is going to raise it because it has to be raised. Steven Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, said the same thing. Paul Ryan has said it. Mitch McConnell has said it. It seems to me the question with the debt limit and also the government shutdown is whether the president's going to sign it. What do you think of that?
It is a very interesting question right now, particularly since Trump had tweeted yesterday, I think it was, saying that he had told McConnell to tie the debt limit to this
VA bill. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And that McConnell, you know, rebuffed him or whatever,
yeah.
which is an interesting comment given that just 3 weeks ago, Mick Mulvaney, the OMB director, said, no, everybody's unanimous in this administration in wanting a clean debt ceiling bill. So it seems like the president is not necessarily talking to the other members of his administration and what they view as the safest and most reliable path towards avoiding another global financial crisis, which is what would happen if we do not raise the debt limit in a timely fashion. So,
yeah,
I mean, where Trump stands on this, who knows? He's all over the map. He doesn't seem to even be following what his own members of the administration are saying or how this debate is unfolding on the Hill.
Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post, Sudeep Reddy at Politico. 5 weeks, by the way, till the debt limit and the budget and all that stuff at the end of September. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks.
Wall Street today, mostly good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Hurricane Harvey is, as of now, a Category 3 storm, the eye of which is just off the coast of Corpus Christi, Texas. There are lives at risk, of course, as with any storm of this size, and the property damage will surely be in the billions of dollars. But the geography of the American petroleum industry means Harvey is going to have business costs that will be felt in wide parts of this country. Andy Lipow is the president of Lipow Oil Associates, based out of Houston, except for today, because he's traveling and can't get home. Mr. Lipow, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
I should say up the top, we have caught you in New York, which gets me to my first question. This storm kind of came out of nowhere in a way, and I'm wondering how that's affecting preparations down on the Texas coast, do you think?
Well, if you're a refiner in Corpus Christi, Texas, you've already shut down your facilities because landfall is expected to make its way there overnight. If you're a refiner or a petrochemical plant in the Houston area, we see some trimming back of operations because it's difficult for the tankers to unload imported crude oil and make its way through this storm system.
When you say shut down, I imagine you can't just flip a switch and take off. That's probably a process, as is restarting refineries after this whole thing is done.
Well, that's exactly right. When refiners need to shut down their facilities, they make that decision about 48 hours prior to the estimated landfall. When they're starting up, of course, it's going to depend on how much damage is sustained. So if we have a Category 3 hurricane approaching the Corpus Christi area, which is going to impact flooding, the power supply, the ability to get workers back to the facility, those refiners might be down for up to 3 weeks.
Well, that seems like a very long time. What does that translate into in terms of the supply of gasoline getting out into the rest of the country? Because something like a third of the capacity, the refining capacity we have is down there.
Well, actually, a third of the capacity in the nation is between the Corpus Christi area and over to Lake Charles. So right now, the Corpus Christi refiners represent only 4.5% of the nation's total capacity. So it's a much smaller impact.
This storm is predicted to be more of a water event, I think, is what the meteorologists say, instead of a wind event, right? There's going to be tidal surges. There's going to be all this rain. How much of a problem is, I guess the word is standing water, right, for these refineries who could conceivably be flooded out?
Well, it can be a very significant problem. The last forecast I saw was for 28 inches of rain in the Houston area and up to 40 inches of rain in some of the surrounding counties. The good news is it's going to happen over 4 to 5 days. So if the refinery has enough capacity to move that water off its grounds, it's not much of an issue. But if you get deluged by rainfall in a short period of time and that water rises, you tend to find your equipment become submerged, and then you have a more significant event because all that equipment has to be repaired, and that can take weeks and months.
Right. What are they telling you about when you're going to be able to get back to Houston?
So I was expecting to go this Sunday, and I talked to people down in Houston. They said there's no reason to come down here, so I fully anticipate getting back there Thursday morning.
Well, best of luck to you, sir. Andy Lipow, he's of Lipow Oil Associates out of Houston, Texas. We got him, as I said, in New York. Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Corporate news of this Friday is out of Seoul, South Korea. J.Y. Lee, as he's known in the West, the son of Samsung's chairman and the guy who was basically running the company, has been convicted of bribing the former president of South Korea and sentenced to 5 years in prison. Bad for Samsung, also possibly a tipping point in the heretofore cozy relationship between South Korean conglomerates and that government. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
Samsung is one of a handful of family-run conglomerates known in South Korea as chaebols. For decades, South Korea's government looked the other way while the chaebols did whatever it took to grow into international powerhouses, but not in J.Y. Lee's case.
Well, it is a huge departure from the normal, and frankly, I didn't predict it.
That's Usha Haley. She teaches international business at West Virginia University. She says for decades, the chaebols were pretty much above the law. In return, they transformed South Korea from a poor country into an economic powerhouse. And today,
the chaebol are responsible for about 80% of Korea's GDP.
Haley says Samsung alone is responsible for 20% of South Korea's exports, and it reported record profits last month. But Stephen Nerper, senior director of the Korea Society, says now Samsung may have to make room for the small businesses it's been crowding out.
People see that if Korea is going to continue to be a leader in innovation, small and medium enterprise development's a huge part of that.
But the chaebol's power won't be curbed overnight. They still have some powerful political friends. Scott Seaman is with Eurasia Group.
There's far less tolerance for this type of collusion. However, this is a process that hasn't been completed yet.
Samsung says it will appeal J.Y. Lee's conviction. His father and grandfather, who started Samsung, were both convicted of various crimes and pardoned. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer from Marketplace.
Whole Foods is officially going to be part of Amazon come Monday. That's when the $14 billion acquisition is set to close. One of the things that put Whole Foods in a position to be bought is that it's been losing sales as competitors have increased their organic offerings at lower prices. Amazon says it's going to turn that around, which, as Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports, is really going to shake up the organic supply chain.
The deal with Amazon will put products including Whole Foods organic salad dressings and cereals just a few clicks away. Amazon will offer the grocers private labels like 365 online. That's huge, according to Jim Hertel with Inmar Willard Bishop Analytics.
Whole Foods 365 brand will be available to literally tens of millions of households here in the U.S. that probably have not been exposed to it before.
In-house brands like 365 require less money spent on stuff like advertising. That's part of why the products are cheaper than name brands. But goosing the sales of Whole Foods store brands could create challenges for name brand organic competitors, which have to vie for ingredients that can be hard to come by, like organic limes or organic jalapenos.
If there's a run on that particular ingredient, it can put you in a really difficult spot.
Nicole Bernard-Dawes is chief executive of the snack company called Late July. All the ingredients in its products, like tortilla chips, are organic.
For us, being organic is a little bit of a hindrance because of the supply chain threats and other issues that we have to deal with that non-organic brands don't.
Dawes says she feels confident enough in her supply chain that the Amazon Whole Foods deal won't cause those sorts of problems. But she acknowledges it would be hard to wring more costs from that supply chain to lower her products' prices at the request of Amazon and Whole Foods.
For us, I mean, we'll never win a price war. Like, we're never going to be that brand.
One possible upside to the Amazon Whole Foods deal, Dawes says getting traction with online food sales has been tough for everyone to figure out. She says if Amazon can, it could actually help food companies like hers. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I didn't realize that at the time, that my military career was going to end because of that explosion.
What happens when you come home? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 30 today, about a 10%, 21,813. NASDAQ down 5 points, basically flat, 62.65. S&P 500 up 4, about a 10%, 24.43. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow Industrial's up 0.6%, the NASDAQ up 0.7%, the S&P 500 also up about 0.7%. Chevron gained 0.7% today as well. Schlumberger, you try saying that 10 times fast, added 1.5%. Insurance companies are sadly going to be busy next week down in Texas. Allstate up 0.5% today. Prudential added about 1.1%. Whole Foods stayed pretty flat today. Amazon shares down 0.7% in the wake of that deal. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.16%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Back on Monday night, President Trump announced a new strategy for the war in Afghanistan and that he is going to send more troops over there. So it's worth taking a minute to hear what happened to one Marine injured in that war and to the combat photographer embedded in his squad when they came home. Finbar O'Reilly, the photographer, spent years covering some of the most dangerous places in the world for Reuters. Thomas J. Brennan, TJ, was based for a time in Helmand Province, Afghanistan. He is a medically retired sergeant in the United States Marine Corps, retired with a traumatic brain injury. Together, they have written a new book about their experiences there. It's called Shooting Ghosts. Guys, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
TJ, give me the story of how you guys met, would you?
So it was around October of 2010. I had been in Afghanistan for about 3 months at that time. We'd just gotten done doing a push through a town called Dekarez. We walk up this hill carrying all of our gear, you know, just hundreds of pounds of stuff, and then we come in and drop it, and I see this gaunt man sitting in the corner. I just walked up to him and said, "Who are you?" And when he said he was with Reuters, and I thought that was a government contract agency that I hadn't heard of before.
I had to explain that I was a journalist and a photographer there to make him famous.
Yeah. So Finbar, the subtitle of this book, the second headline, if you will, is it says a U.S. Marine, a combat photographer, and their journey back from war. But there is the key event is when TJ gets injured. And I want you to tell me about that day and what you saw.
We'd been out on a number of patrols, foot patrols, through the area, which was a Taliban stronghold. And on the day that TJ got injured, the Taliban attacked in an ambush. And TJ and another Marine were running up to reposition themselves further ahead of where I was stationed inside a compound for cover, when we heard another explosion, and we thought it was TJ stepping on an improvised explosive device, but it turned out that it was an African National Police member who was with the Marines and misfired his rocket, and it hit a telegraph pole above TJ, knocking him out. And I was actually photographing this, so we have the whole kind of sequence of that happening. You know, the Marines who ran to the position where TJ was knocked out and reviving him and helping him to stagger back into the compound, where I photographed him sort of falling down to his knees and then being administered first aid by the Navy corpsman who was there.
The thing that got this book to my attention for this program, TJ, is that moment. And you say you don't know whether you'd have been a career Marine or not, and you had problems with bureaucracy and the stupidity of the Marine Corps and you know, all of that. But it seemed to me that that was the moment when that RPG hit, when your life changed, obviously, but also the idea of this job that you had of being a Marine, and Finbar, for you too, really, as a photojournalist, as a combat photojournalist, that job was in a way taken away from you.
Yes, it was. I didn't realize that at the time that my military career was going to end because of that explosion. I actually clung to hope for a long time that things would get better, which my doctors told me they would, and that I would be able to salvage my Marine Corps career. And I wanted to go be a combat instructor at the School of Infantry. I didn't think it would be a career-ending injury. But then when I found out it was, that's when things got very difficult, because I knew it was out of my hands.
And just to fill in some of the gaps, I mean, you went through treatment and depression and more treatment. There was a suicide attempt, all of which took a toll on your domestic life and your family life because of this one thing that happened.
Yeah, it was a so when I first came home, March, April timeframe of 2011, the doctors for all the reevaluations back in the United States, they told me that I was going to be okay and that things would improve. And then they said, you know, things are not going to improve. We're going to refer you to a medical board. I forget where you were going with that.
Well, it's about the change that got forced upon you. Yeah, well, you were going, but you know what? But that's okay. It's about things, how things change. But Finbar, let me ask you how you guys reconnected. You stayed in touch, but you really reconnected sort of in the anecdote that's at the beginning of this book.
Yeah, when I left TJ in Afghanistan, I kind of thought that might be the end of the story. And no, I'd met many subjects who I'd photographed over the years that I spend a chunk of time with that's very intense at the moment, and you don't always expect to see them again. But we did reconnect through writing, and he ended up writing a piece for the New York Times about what it was like to be on the other side of my camera.
Yeah.
And that sparked a kind of communication between us when TJ decided he wanted to start writing about his experiences and the challenges of seeking mental health in the military. And when he sent me that first piece, I was impressed by how raw and emotive it was. And I thought, wow, he has really something interesting to say here. And if he were willing to share it beyond just with me and for his own sort of processing of his experiences, then it could have real value for others who are going through similar things.
TJ, let me pick up on that for a minute, because Afghanistan is again in the news this week. You have had the experience of going there and being injured and coming back. And I feel obliged to ask you, since you now have this platform, about the disconnect between the civilian and military sides of this society as we enter, I think, year 17 of the war in Afghanistan.
So the book touches on a whole lot of difficult topics, mm-hmm. that are it's tough to talk about them. And I hope that when people put down the book and they finish reading it, that it helps to reframe the conversation about the positive aspects of military service that don't otherwise get talked about. I mean, we have veterans each and every day that are absolutely crushing it in academia and social impact and entrepreneurship. Yet it seems more often than not that the headline in the newspaper is the crazy vet that shoots somewhere, whereas I would make the argument that veterans are drastically outperforming a lot of their civilian counterparts.
I think one of the main reasons really for us writing the book, and certainly for TJ, I know, and from our conversations, is that he wanted to bridge this gap between the civilian experience or idea of war and the military experience. And so by putting these things together and comparing our experiences, we were able to really kind of bridge that gap between what civilians think war is and what it really might be like.
The book is called Shooting Ghosts. I cannot recommend it highly enough. Thomas J. Brennan, United States Marine Corps retired, and Finbar O'Reilly. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much indeed, Guy.
All right, so two things about that interview. First of all, we've got some of Finbar O'Reilly's photography at marketplace.org. Also, there is another piece of tape that I need you to hear. Remember back when we were talking, in the middle of an answer, TJ just kind of lost the bubble, couldn't finish his thought. And after we were done talking, I asked him about it. Here's what he said. And all of the pauses you're going to hear, by the way, are in the original tape.
I don't remember what I said.
Okay. Well, no. Well, I asked a convoluted question and you gave a long answer and then you lost your train of thought halfway through.
I'm used to people seeing that I forget stuff by now, so.
So this final note on the way out today, in which size matters, a federal appeals court in Chicago has thrown out a settlement meant to dispose of class action lawsuit against Subway, the sandwich shop. The suit was initially brought by an Australian teenager who had measured his footlong sub and found it to be only 11 inches long. The court said of the settlement, which got plaintiff's lawyers $500,000 and $5,000 for each plaintiff, it said, quote, a class action that seeks only worthless benefits for the class and yields only fees for class counsel is no better than a racket. Okay, we're gone. The Dow added 30 today, about a 10%. NASDAQ down 5. S&P 500 up 4, about a 10%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rosedale. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. We'll be back on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.